The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Welcome to the program. We are about to talk about all things economic with our guest, Joe Davis. He's the Global Chief Economist at Vanguard. Vanguard now has $5 trillion worth of assets under management. It is the company that the entire private wealth industry basically fears that they're going to get devoured by. Joe Davis has no such hegemonic intentions, I can assure you. He is the head, though, of Vanguard's investment strategy group, whose research results in the development of the asset allocation strategies that Vanguard uses in its index funds. And perhaps beyond the index funds, I'll talk to Joe about that in a moment. He's actually on the phone from the Philadelphia area headquarters for Vanguard. Joe Davis, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
You know, that's my first question does revolve around the whole index fund thing, because here you are sussing out the economic information out there, trying to figure out the twists and turns of the economy, looking down the road. Beyond the index funds, let me just put it this way. How is what you find out there as an economist and share with the investment committee, how is it actually applied? Because we tend to think of Vanguard as index funds, and you're basically betting on the entire stock market, and the stock market has done nothing but go up over time, so pretty good bet there. But how does the information that you and your team find out there through your research get applied to the investment strategies?
It's a great question. It's a fair question. This is not the first time I've gotten asked the question, why does Vanguard have an economist? So first, Vanguard has long believed and has a number of products that are just low cost in nature. So we firmly believe in active management. We have hundreds of billions of dollars in actively managed products, both active as well as fixed income. So, which I think sometimes can be lost in the public conversation. Ultimately, we believe in both active and passive management, as long as they are low cost in nature. So, so that's where the role of the economist, one important role that the economist comes in terms of our economic analysis and help and input to the active managers, particularly on the fixed income side, where our perspective on the global economy may add value and inform the active decisions around our interest rate posture and our credit exposure for all of our actively managed bond funds, in the billions of dollars that clients have entrusted our portfolio managers there. Yeah, so that's the one key internal responsibility that I would convey for our economic analysis. The other one is just for broad investors of either active or index stripes, and that is all investors, I think, have to grapple at the end of the day with what is a reasonable asset allocation for whatever solution that they're trying to solve for it. And that's where, the main ingredients for any asset allocation strategy is what are reasonable return expectations for the various assets we may combine into a portfolio, stocks, bonds, alternatives, and so forth. And so, myself and our economics team and our investment strategy group, we spend a lot of time and have a lot, have developed over the past decade a lot of, fairly deep models and frameworks to display to clients what those reasonable expectations for returns are, what's the potential volatility of those returns, and how they may co-move through time. So that's the other important input that our economic analysis can help frame with. It's valuation based as well as risk based. It's probability based, and that has an influence in terms of conveying to clients what are the likelihoods, what's the likelihood of success for any investment strategy, whether it's actively managed or passively implemented.
And then, of course, there's these exogenous events that take place that challenge certain assumptions. Let's take recent event. Some people might not even call this an exogenous event, but the Trump administration suddenly says China's cheating. We're going to slap tariffs on them and anybody else who gets in our way. And the markets didn't react very favorably to that. But since then, things have quelled a little bit, and it almost seems that. Because China realizes the economic damage that can be done to it, as well as the United States, that they are now talking on a more specific level about maybe even cutting some trade deals that are specific to certain industries or product categories. What's your assessment of that? Maybe politically you have an opinion on it, but more to the point, from an economist's point of view and all the investors that you represent, how does this play into your calculations?
Yeah, well, you know, we do a lot of, you know, which all your listeners may or may not be surprised to learn. You know, we spend a lot. Vanguard's actually very quantitative in nature, and so we spend a lot of time internally quantifying everything as best we can. But we would be the first one to acknowledge that things such as geopolitical risk, political scenarios, if they can be modeled, it's very tough to do so. So this is where qualitative judgment importantly comes in, and so we always are looking at what are the quote unquote tail risks or various scenarios that are currently not priced in the financial markets, both on the upside as well as the downside. Trade is something that we identified, you know, because we look our economic framework. We look over three secular forces always to underpin our economic and market outlook. Those three forces are around globalization, demographics, and technology. And globalization. We alone identified a few years ago as this relationship between the U.S. and China that we were going to continue to see trade tensions, and so we've always had that on our risk scorecard, so to speak, and we think there remains non-trivial risk that we will see increased rhetoric and even a potential escalation in the tit-for-tat tariffs that we see. We still think it's a very low odds, though, that we would see what some would call a full-out trade war. But we can't completely eliminate it. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why, I think we're at this stage of the cycle for those of us, for those active strategies that we oversee, that we're not completely aggressive in nature, because that's a significant, I mean, it's a risk to the outlook. But again, it's not something that I think we will. I think we're going to continue to see rhetoric at times. Ultimately, we believe that we will see trade negotiations between the U.S. and China, but volatility may rise at intermittent points, and I don't think we're through that course until we see those trade negotiations play out.
Let's talk interest rates, because the Fed has made it clear interest rates are going to rise. They have risen. They're going to rise some more. Meanwhile, we've had these tax cuts to stimulate the economy. Higher interest rates can restrain the economy somewhat. The Trump administration is really counting on getting growth, GDP growth over 3%. And it says if it gets, I think, to 3.1 or 3.2%, we will have enough additional tax receipts, despite the tax cut, that we can start balancing the budget. Now, there are people who definitely have taken some issue with that. But what about the push and pull between the Fed and the Trump administration, just in terms of it's a go, go, go mentality in the White House. Meanwhile, the Fed is saying, we don't want this economy to overheat, so let's keep things under control here. What's your thoughts on interest rates in terms of hiking them right now? Is that something that you think is a wise idea to help prolong this economic expansion we're in?
Yeah, I mean, we've generally been of that mind. I mean, I'm very proud that, this is, it's always tough to ascertain the future in many ways. And the bond market can be a very humbler in terms of getting ahead actually of most economists. But I'm very proud of the outlook we've had. You know, we were of the mind, well more than a year ago, that the Federal Reserve, as we approached full employment, that the Federal Reserve was going to become increasingly emboldened, despite still low inflation, to gradually normalize policy, more so than the bond market, I think, at the time, and, up until that time, had correctly been skeptical of. But, as we were of the mind going into the year, the Federal Reserve was going to raise rates three times this year and as many as three times next year, which would bring the Fed funds rate close to 3%. Now, again, this is an outlook that we've maintained because of how we view the economy increasingly at or near full employment. So it had very little to do with our growth outlook. In fact, I think that course of action is appropriate regardless of whether GDP growth is 2 or 3%. And I think that's been underestimated by the bond market, that we are not going to need to see an acceleration in growth, and we may not even see it this year, despite the fiscal package that has been enacted, that the Federal Reserve is going to continue to gradually normalize, particularly in the backdrop of a modest cyclical uptick in inflation. It's really due to the tightness in the labor market. And so I think we went into the year saying for the first time in 10 years, the Federal Reserve's forecast for higher short-term rates was going to be more likely accurate than the bond markets, which up until that time had been, had won effectively every annual contest for 9 years running, because the bond market went into every year saying, at best, Federal Reserve, you may raise rates once. And it was in large part given our diagnosis that despite a low-growth world, we were going to have ever tighter labor markets because of some of the supply side forces that have lowered the potential growth rate in the U.S. And I think that view has been vindicated, quite frankly. So that's our view. I have framed it similarly that I think the Federal Reserve, once they became comfortable that the U.S. economy is, if it's not at full employment, it's at least close to it. And so normalizing interest rates is more has to do with ensuring a longer business expansion rather than stunting it, and which is really where they're coming from. And so I think we will continue to see, unless we see a material deterioration in the economic outlook, the Federal Reserve will continue to raise rates a little bit more faster or aggressively than the bond market is given credit for. I think as we sit here today, the bond market has now priced in three, which they weren't doing. So I think that outlook has now been priced in. But I think 2019, the bond market's still skeptical, and I think the bond market, may start to reprice if we continue to see the modest momentum in the labor market, which we have seen to date. Now that said, that's a view on the short-term interest rates. We are still hard pressed, and we said this in our outlook beginning of the year. We're hard-pressed to see long-term interest rates rise materially, if at all, over the course of this year, which implied to us that we will continue to see flatter yield curves, or the difference between, say, 10-year Treasury security and 2 years. And I think we have seen that to date, and we could see that more. In fact, we may even see a slight inversion of the curve as we approach this year, because the long end of the curve has very little to do at times with Fed policy and much more to do with global policy and global forces, which we're hard pressed to see long-term interest rates, say, above 3.25% or 3.5%. We're really hard pressed to see those scenarios. I mean, they're possible, but they're not our baseline. So, I do separate, the sort of short-term interest rates. We will continue to likely see a modest rise, but the long end of the curve could more around dance around these current levels, given how we've diagnosed these competing cyclical and secular forces.
So one of the other macroeconomic issues that people are keeping an eye on is debt. And we were just talking about this in the news meeting the other day. You've got China, which is really a linchpin in the global economy, trying to manage a load of debt. We've got all kinds of debt problems. You look at Greece, you look at Italy, you look around the world, there's a lot of debt. In fact, one of our editors handed me an article she just wrote about global debt reaching a record $233 trillion in the third quarter 2017. That's according to the Institute of International Finance in their publication Global Debt Monitor. That's a lot of debt, Joe. And you know, when did we pass,
it is.
I mean, when do we pass the Rubicon? It just seems like people have been fearing debt. It keeps piling up. And yet we have a lot of global growth, a lot of emerging economies, a lot of middle classes rising up around the world. Is there, I mean, when do we actually cross the Rubicon where it becomes the day of reckoning?
Yeah, I think, you know, longer term, if we're bold enough to look out 5-10 years, I think it's arguably the seminal question. I mean, for nations, for investors, and for policymakers of all variants. So, how we've thought about it is two things. One is, you know, the levels of debt and deficit do matter for interest rates and other things, but that's all else equal. And I do stress all else equal because, you know, even if you look over our nation's history, there is zero correlation. Zero between the level of debt and interest rates, or I should say the level of deficits and interest rates. But that does not mean that deficits and debt don't matter. It's just that other forces can offset, you know, what you would expect, higher levels of debt, higher interest rates, and potentially other pressures on an economy. So it's just important to appreciate those other forces. I think, you know, so two things. One is it's certainly a little sobering, the amount of debt that continues to build up in the global market, in the global economy. And, you know, it's funny, for several years I know many were talking about the great deleveraging, and I used to say, well, what deleveraging? Because the level of debt is higher today than it was before the global financial crisis. That said, I think how we sometimes frame it, debt as a percentage of GDP, you know, arguably is the wrong metric. I mean, we also have to look, we should be looking at debt as a percentage of world wealth, because it's a stock of debt versus a stock of wealth, and a world that is wealthier, that is also has a higher level of savings, the highest level of global savings that we've ever had. That investment and level of debt should be higher as well. Now, when you do that, and when we've done that, we're still, you know, approaching levels that are uncomfortable, and so. But history shows that two things. One is this continued upward path in the level of debt is unsustainable. So that's not going to be, I mean, that's a statement of the obvious for me. Secondly, though, is they can continue for some time. So then the key question is, you know, what's the tipping point? I think it depends. It truly varies by country. Some countries, I can't go on forever. Emerging markets have a much lower threshold to be able to sustain the level of debts. Now, I don't have any specific countries in mind that they're in eminent shape, but 2011 and the European crisis clearly showed that you do not have to have a debt level of 150% of debt to GDP to have significant pressures, where Italy and Ireland and Greece were, susceptible to those sort of market pressures. In the U.S., I am not Pollyannish on the issue. I'm far from it. But I think, you know, the bond market will give us time until there is a viable global alternative to the U.S. dollar as the international reserve currency. And so I think until China fully opens their capital account and fully floats their currency, which by then we would mean we would have a very deep, liquid bond market that overseas investors could invest in. I think at that point, U.S. Treasuries will have a significant competitor, and that's where you could see upward pressure on U.S. long-term interest rates given our debt trajectory. But until then, I think the other forces have and will continue to keep a lid on long-term interest rates. Again, I could be wrong, but the baseline has been right, at least to date. But that is not a foregone conclusion that will continue. It would be China's economic development, ironically, that could lead to the upward pressure on our own interest rates.
Well, you bring up a good point. The debt to GDP ratio is really key to the question. But when we're talking about debt, You know, we also want to think in terms of inflation. Now, you were saying that there is historically no correlation between debt and interest rates, but we have done a lot of quantitative easing. We've been printing a lot of money. There's reasons why people would be concerned that inflation is going to break out, and it really hasn't happened. And one of the three big categories that you guys study, you mentioned globalization, demographics, and technology. It seems the technology has taken an awful lot of cost out of a lot of different systems within the economy. Do you think the technology is one of the things that's, or is it the thing that's kept a lid on inflation? Or are there some, what do you think are the dynamics that have really kept inflation under control at a time when it should be spiraling right now?
Yeah, it should be spiraling. I mean, it's a fair question. Again, I mean, over the past 10 years, it's still probably the most popular, most common question I get, either, you know, investors, you know, very concerned and convinced that inflation will take off, or just very perplexed as to why it hasn't at all. And, you know, it's probably the biggest phenomenon that we've analyzed statistically. And I can tell you, there's been three forces that I think have and will continue, at least on a long-run basis, to keep inflation down. That does not mean that you can't have higher inflation, but you have to overcome three forces. And those three forces are, the first one is a good thing. The first one is just greater central bank credibility. And what that means is that it takes a lot to make inflation deviate from where a central bank wants it to be. I mean, think of it at the end of the day. If everyone believes that inflation is not going to break out, then by definition it doesn't, which sounds circular, but actually has a lot of theoretical underpinnings. It's something that we didn't have in the 50s and 60s when inflation started this long march up and interest rate followed. So although credibility can be lost, that's likely to keep the inflation 2% plus or minus a corridor based upon volatility in the business cycle. So that's actually why central banks want and talk about well-anchored inflation expectations, because it means it's something they don't have to squish or prop up on a significant basis. The second factor of the three is actually overrated, and that's globalization. Yes, globalization has kept inflation down. You know, the rise of China and the entrance of China and India and other emerging economies into the global financial system has also, you know, introduced a huge addition to the labor market. It's what economists would call positive supply shock, which just means the supply curve moved out, and so all sequels should lower price pressures. And I think that's, you know, that's winnowing in on its effect, given the development of many emerging economies. That has had some influence, but I think the third point has been underestimated, and we at least attempted to quantify the impact of technology, and to be explicit, the rise in increased usage of computer and digital-based technology in the economy. And what we found is that, somewhat surprising to us, that 50 basis points has been the average annual subtraction of technology's increased usage in the global economy every year to core inflation, which I think is important because 50 basis points has been effectively the difference between, say, in the United States, where core inflation has been over the past 15 years. It's averaged roughly 1.5%. All the meanwhile, the Fed's wanted it close to 2%. And so that difference can largely be explained, all sequel, by the rise of computer and digital technology. And what I mean by that is not like Amazon Prime per se, because someone will say that and some will look at it and they'll say, well, that can't really explain the shortfall inflation. What I talk about technology's rise is what we found is, say, 20 years ago, the average for $1 of GDP, we used 8 cents of computer and digital technology to produce $1 of GDP. Today, we use 20 cents of technology to produce that same $1 GDP. So it's ironic that computers and digital technology, social platforms, so forth, they're pervasive and they're all in front of us, yet I think until recently, economists had not sort of quantified that drag on inflation. And again, it's what we call Moore's Law. It's the fact that the relative price of this technology is falling so rapidly and so quickly that that relative price keeps a lid or allows price pressures to be consumed or offset at the margin by companies. So it just means that the hurdle rate to have higher inflation is just a little bit higher. It's not that we can't have core inflation of 2.5% and 3%. We can. It's just that that sort of cyclical thrust of the economy or tightness in the labor market has to be stronger today than it would have been in the 80s or 1990s to offset that 50 basis point drag from Moore's Law. Which, you know, which is why we still think at the margin over the next 10 years, I still think central banks will struggle to keep core inflation, push it up towards 2 rather than tamp it down from above 2, which, you know, which was generally the case when I entered the profession in the late 80s and 1990s.
Let's go back to that big three, the trio you mentioned, globalization, demographics, and technology. And let's zero in on demographics. We have, China is getting close to now becoming quite an aging society. Italy is very old. Japan, I believe, is the oldest society. And if we keep chasing off young immigrants here in the United States, we are also going to become an aging society. And it's happening around the world. You know that, Joe. And the record on this is that, you know, an old population or declining population is not good for an economy. So when you look at the demographic picture around the world, what's the pluses and minuses there?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, clearly, you know, it's almost arithmetically by construction or by definition that, you know, the lower the population growth rate, or the higher, you know, perhaps the higher the age profile of an economy, particularly if you have individuals leaving the workforce. So it all has to do with labor force growth. The lower that growth rate is, the lower the overall economic nominal GDP growth you're going to have. I mean, because that's just the sum of that plus productivity. So that's given. I think that has had a modest downward pressure on interest rates, but I think demographics at times can be pushed a little too far, at least relative to what at least has been the historical relationship across countries over the past 50 years, 100 years. And what you find is generally there's certainly not a strong and robust relationship between population growth and what I would call the variable that really matters, which is productivity growth, return on capital. There really isn't. And in fact, there's a very poor relationship as well between the aging of an economy and as well the return on capital or the aging or the productivity growth rate, which is really drives standards of living and, you know, the wealth of nations. You know, in many ways, and when some investors are surprised by that, but I do say, listen, you know, demographics do matter, but you know, if fast growing populations were the primary driver of everything that we cared about as investors, then, you know, the largest populated economies, the Indias of the world, would be the wealthiest, and they're far from it. It would also mean that, you know, the world has been aging since in many ways the caveman. Longevity continues to increase, and wealth has increased with it. So again, I'm not dismissive of demographics. There's, you know, and I think Japan, we don't have, to be fair, you know, to come back to the statements I just made is, okay, Joe, there may be a difference between slowing population growth and outright contractions in population. And there we have, you know, we don't have as many historical precedents. So, you know, if you look to a Japan or someone else, you know, it's, you know, you don't like to really compare a lot of economic success with Japan. It's not a peer group always to be associated with, very little, you know, very little growth over time. But again, I think to the metrics that should matter to investors, it's around valuations and productive return on capital. And if you look at productivity growth rates, actually in the past 5 years, Japan's had the highest productivity growth rate of all the major economies. So I think that's a lot to take in. I mean, the first order effects, any economy that is aging and has higher retiring population, slower growth rates around population, immigration rates, will clearly have a lower GDP nominal growth rate. But there's a very poor association for long-term asset allocators. If they care about that, there's a very poor correlation between population variables and future stock returns, because it's the price paid for growth and the valuation metrics that have much more predictability, or I would say reliability of signal to investment opportunities. So that's how we generally frame it. So we tend to look beyond demographics, because, you know, I think it's easy to look at those poor demographic profiles, and clearly that means the demand curve is a little bit weaker. It may not move out as quickly. But why we also stressed it in the U.S. case the past 2 years, the demographics also meant that we were likely going to have a very tight labor market in a few years. When we looked at this 3 years ago, a very tight labor market without any acceleration in growth. So here we are today with 2% GDP growth, pretty much 2% growth for the past 10 years. We have not seen any acceleration in U.S. economic growth, yet the unemployment rate has gone from 10 to 7 to 5 and now approaching 4. That's in large part because the supply curve has moved as well, and I think that's at least important for us to keep in mind. If we say demographics matter, let's at least account for both the shift in demand and supply, because those two things may offset with respect to interest rate or stock market strategies.
Interesting. So let's talk about the major economic issues that you see going unaddressed by the mechanisms of government, through regulation, through the corporate world, just these major issues that you don't see getting addressed. In other words, if you were brought in before business and political leaders and they said, Joe, what do we really need to do to set things right and set the table for solid future growth, what would you say? I asked this, you know, you're a very positive guy, you know, so much for the dismal science, economics being the dismal science. In your hands, economics don't sound dismal, yeah. Joe. You sound like a pretty positive guy about this stuff, and everything sounds pretty manageable to you right now. But what scares you out there? What would you change? What would you tell people to really spend time addressing?
Yeah, you know, I'm generally more a cautiously optimistic person, but there are some serious things that I wish. To be honest, I get frustrated at times, and this is me, Joe, as just a citizen, Joe from Malvern, Pennsylvania. You know, one is, you know, so I think, you know, this you know, we talk about, you know, technology. Many we'll continue to talk about the threat of automation and job loss, and that's, you know, we're in the early innings of this, and so there's things to be concerned about. However, when you look at it, the irony will be in the next 10 years, we will not have a lack of demand for jobs. We will actually have labor shortages. Once you look at how technology disrupts tasks and not jobs. Now, why I bring that up, we are, though, however, going to need significant, what I would call uptasking or what some would call reskilling. From one occupation to another, or one type of task to another. So, and I think that the U.S. and I think the global economy will actually struggle. There will be a credible amount of demand on certain tasks versus others. So I wish there was more effort around, and I think it's primarily going to happen in the private sector, educators will call you around the concept of lifelong learning. But I think as economists, I think we've done a poor job of stressing the positive benefits of on-the-job training, whether it's formal in the classroom or it's outside of it, thinking perhaps creatively. And I'm not an educator, so, you know, others thinking creatively in terms of how we can think of real on-time skill up training, because I think there's a great value to that. I think technological disruption and AI will only push that. I think the companies that solve that, by the way, will be winners in any portfolio, because I think there will be a global arms race for talent, which has been the primary driver of income inequality. Which brings me to the second thing. I mean, if the rise of the level of debt has been eye-watering, and I think it has been, there's another chart that, at least in my eyes, they water even more, and that is the rise of income inequality. you know, which Piketty and others have talked about in some of their books, and some have heard. And you know, technology, by our analysis, technology is driving that. It's not per se how it's framed generally in the political sphere of, say, competing with China in trade. That has had some influence, but it's dwarfed in our and other academic analysis by technology and how that is what is creating increasingly what I would call a winner-take-all economy. So where I say, the importance of education has never been more important. So I from a structural reform perspective, monetary policy is important, yes. Fiscal policy is important, yes. But I wish where I wish policymakers, where we could get greater impact on is around education policy, how we think of job training for those of you who have lost their job through trade. I've been an economist who's been on stage, and I must admit at times in the past I've said, free trade, Adam Smith, you wave your hands and say, well, the invisible hand will work out. But there's significant, almost at times permanent pain in communities that have lost jobs through technology and or trade. So I think it's really around the education and jobs sphere that I think global economies will have to think a little bit more seriously about. Not to say you can't do some of that through the tax code, but, you know, for the past 10 years, central banks have done an incredible amount of lifting. And so I think much more important in the years ahead, even more so than economic growth rates, will be the distribution of growth within the economy. Because the trends have, almost any economy I've looked at, the trends have been to more income inequality. And so I think we're just clearly going to continue to be part of the conversation. But I think it's going to require more diagnosis as to what's really driving that, to help provide a solution if it has one. I think it's always through education and opportunity. I'd hope it won't be through a knee-jerk reactions to, thinking that there's an obvious cause and hence rush to a solution. I think it's going to take a national and global dialogue as to what's driving this. And to be thoughtful that perhaps you can have a little bit more inclusive growth without undercutting, you know, some of the wonderful attributes of a freely floating capital system, which has its many, many merits. So I think that's the debate that I think is starting to occur, but I think over the next 5 or 10 years, I would hope that we have a more serious conversation on it. I think the trends almost, dictate that we will have that in some way, shape, or form.
Well, you mentioned standing on stage talking about free markets, and the United States has demonstrated now for decades that free markets, capitalism, democracy are a very powerful tonic that results in the maximum good for the most people, tremendous economic growth and such. But today we look at China and you see a one-party centralized system of planning and rule. They are now espousing their own formula there, saying we actually have a better system because we have the ability to act swiftly and decisively. You have to admit that our system is one where there's a tremendous amount of frustration in trying to get things done. No such delay in China. They make a decision and they act very swiftly on it. Is that going to prove over the long term to be a higher performance model than democracy and capitalism? And I say this, Joe, with the background of, and I'm old enough and maybe you're old enough to remember when Japan was eating our lunch and everybody said, hey, Japan's got an industrial policy and we don't. We need an industrial policy. In the end, they're, as of today, there's not a country in the world that wouldn't trade places with the United States economy, and Japan had two lost decades. So we tend to get agitated or excited about what's happening somewhere else, only to find out that our system's more durable over the long haul. But is it? China's making a pretty
impressive case. I think you've hit on the head. It's one of the other seminal. I mean, you're hitting on some great points. I mean, one of the seminal issues here. I mean, because it doesn't. You know, we're going to be challenged. You get me on. You said I'm generally an optimistic person. You get me on one of those pessimistic days, and I was. I've been to China a number of times. I was at China last month, and part of me said, "Listen, does walking through Shanghai today, is that what it felt like if you were a British citizen walking through Manhattan in the United States in the year 1900, where this is the new economic superpower? If it's not now, it soon will be. And as an economic historian, having done work there, the thought has crossed my mind. I think it's there are formidable economy. I think they are proving, the very deep skeptics that existed in the economist community that you cannot have a significant period of economic development and success under a centrally planned economy. My working career, you mentioned Japan, you're jaundiced a bit by saying, well, the last central planned economy was the Soviet Union, and that really didn't work out too well. But I think if you look much more broadly at China's long-term, economic development, they are, I think, in many ways being very thoughtful in terms of how they're trying to balance infant industry, as well as infant industry arguments, at the same time trying to open their system increasingly to foreign competition. I mean, to be fair, I think some of what's coming out in the debate today, you could have in criticisms to China, not all, but some of the criticisms you could have launched and people and individuals did to the United States during our rapid development. Now that goes back farther in time, but so I think there's three things that are clear to me. One is that, and we've been of the view, China's economic development will continue. These concerns that erupted every period of time around a hard landing, I think, are misplaced. We still have longer term concerns of their. Are they willing to really address the inefficiency of their state-owned enterprises? Because that's really the Achilles heel of China from an economic standpoint. Part of that is a political, relationship they have in certain their key industries. But part of this is going to be I will give credit. I mean, at the end of the day, they have some, strong tailwinds that we in the U.S. have shared, and that is, a deep, large, educated workforce. And at the end of the day, if you had to pick one variable and bet on economy, that's the variable you pick on. That's even more important, I would argue, than even the type of institutions that would have. Now, some very smart economists would just take issue with what I said, but there's empirical support on my side as well. So I think it's... I'm trying not to have a Western bias as an American here on it. It's by far the most significant economic sort of competition that the U.S. has or will face, certainly in my lifetime, and I think in my children's lifetime as well. So, but it doesn't have to be a zero-sum argument as well. Again, but these tensions are going to come up, for those viewers that are more skeptical, the biggest concern is still around the political, around China's increased interest to have a regional and a more global sort of leadership profile on the world stage, and how does that coincide with the United States role as an economic and military superpower. So I think it's understandable to have some sort of increased tension, but as long as I continue to see the communication lines open between the two economies and the fact that individual workers and citizens continue to emigrate between the two economies, that's always a good sign. When those two sort of conditions start to fall, that's usually when the concern for more serious, confrontations or paths start to emerge. I would hope that wouldn't happen.
So you mentioned the Achilles heel, one potential Achilles heel being the inefficiency of state-owned enterprises. What about the Achilles heel of having a small group of mostly men and some women making decisions, a centralized decision making, when they're wrong, it ripples across the entire economy. A bad decision at the top can contrast that with the U.S. I tend to think of the United States as a portfolio approach, where you have tens of thousands of business leaders representing many thousands of companies, all making these individual decisions. Some are going to be winners, some are going to be losers, but because you've kind of indexed it, if you will, Joe, you're going to have...
That's a good way to frame it.
I mean, it's kind of a portfolio approach to the whole decision-making and where the economy needs to go or should go. I could see China, let's say the Silk Road Project. What if that's a bust and all the money that's going into it? And they're not very popular with their neighbors. So what about
that? Yeah, I tell you, that's a really good framework. Yeah, that's a really good one. You know, I'm going to have to borrow that one. You know, I'll have to cite you, of course, you know, attribution where attribution is due. But, and shame on me, you know, here's Vanguard, the big diversifier and indexer, not think of that as a framework. But, yeah, the democracy, you know, at the end of the day, the quote-unquote market signal, you know, the power of the power of the crowd and the wisdom of the crowd, and the voice of many helping to influence an outcome, you know, clearly that by many ways should have an advantage over any small group making decisions. I firmly believe at the end of the day, a democratic system, despite all of its warts, is the most appropriate. It's most likely to be successful in the long run, just because the ability of any very small group to consistently devane the appropriate policy, right? So that framework is like a framework of active managers. There's clearly skill in the world, but man, having a 3-stock portfolio and you miss out on the 4% of stocks that account for 95% of the stock market's return over the past 60 years, and you can have all the skill in the world, and you're probably going to underperform the market. So there is a risk of China, clearly, of the concentration, and what, you know, if that was an investment committee, the biases that would create of everything from reaffirmation bias to anchoring bias. So I think there's truth in that sort of, you know, it's appropriate to think that through that framework, I think what they're trying to do is navigate this balance between, you know, no question who's in charge and from the political party perspective, but then from an economic perspective, trying to let market forces have more influence than they ever have. They're certainly not at market like, you know, 100% market sort of forces, but they're trying to let those forces, you know, permeate more and more through. At what point do those two belief systems rub against each other? And remains to be seen. I think there is a point with which, can a political system that is really strongly controlled like that allow the economy itself to function freely? Maybe it can. I think that is the big open question, right? If it does, that would mean that, you know, a lot of the economic issues and cyclical concerns just don't have a political fallout, which is probably naive to think. If the U.S. or the U.K. or any economy is to be believed, but yeah, that's the big question. But China is clearly, it's made myself question a little bit, you know, the Western framework that I've, you know, generally learned and applied through, since it's really the Western world that is 90% plus of the observations. And when we talk about economic development and institutions and world wealth over the past 30 years, I mean, excuse me, the past 300 years, that's where the Industrial Revolution really, you know, started and spread. So, China's challenging that system, but I think it's more to come, but I don't see gross missteps, at least in the near term. And if there are missteps from a policy perspective, I think what they are showing though is the ability to really change direction very quickly. To use that portfolio analogy, they have a very concentrated high tracking error portfolio. I think they've been generating positive alpha for some time, but yeah, that may not always continue.
So, Joe, you've been really generous with your time, and I've got one final question for you. I'm going to get out there a little bit on this one, because I want to talk to you about the what some people refer to as the jobless future, the quasi-jobless future. There is concern about artificial intelligence, robotics, automation, and so on, wiping out millions of jobs. I mean, just autonomous trucks and vehicles alone, there's millions of jobs there, almost entirely male. Jobs that could get wiped out. And it kind of forces us to rethink free market capitalism. You're talking about a winner-take-all society. It seems more and more concentration of wealth. If there's fewer and fewer jobs, we have to rethink, what about distribution of wealth? What about basic universal income, perhaps? And then each individual just kind of tries to build a career or lifestyle from there. Yeah, so how serious and for that matter exhilarating are the prospects of an economy that creates tremendous wealth with diminishing employment? I mean, over time, we can work fewer hours, we get paid vacations and all of that. Everybody thinks that's good, but it's interesting how disconcerted people get at the notion of not having a job, even though a society could be structured. In fact, there's models of it, places like Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, where there's people who don't work, but they actually have quite a interesting lifestyle. They're paid money through the government, it's commodity based and not sustainable. What we're talking about is a highly technological society or societies around the world, significantly curtailed work hours. Long winded question here, Joe, but what about the dream of the android, the golden era of androids? Doing basically everything from construction to driving to cleaning our households, and does it represent an opportunity?
I think we do. We spend a lot of time. I started talking about this with clients. We did a lot of research, more than 2 years ago, in terms of what's just the future work. Because if you see the development of AI, machine learning, automation. If you're a sci-fi fan, you love it. If you're driving a truck, perhaps you're concerned. And I think understandably. But however, I do think in our analysis would bear out. We're of the mind that the issue is in some way misframed, in that. There's a study out there by Oxford University several years ago that said, based upon current technology, not stuff in Star Wars or Star Trek, but stuff in current technology used by companies today in the field, that roughly 50% of the jobs in the United States will be automated away in the next 10 years. And if he thought 50% is high, it's 77% in China, which goes against some of their, hey, China will take over the world. But that is misframed. What we looked at is too simplistic. We're a little bit more optimistic than that, but we're certainly not Pollyanna. So the good news is that when you look at it, jobs per se don't get automated away. Tasks do. And most jobs have a number of critically important tasks. So I think what's lost in the conversation is, in fact, that's why they call most of our life is multitasking, right? I mean, when you look at it, we got data that looked at, there's 18,000 work activities that occur in the United States every day, and when you bucket them into like 41 we call sort of tasks. Think of tasks, think of a verb like building or designing or managing. That's a task. And, jobs, there's over 1,000 occupations. The average job has anywhere between 7 to 10 critically important tasks. And then when you look at the type of tasks that computer technology can do, they can certainly automate what we would call repetitive, you know, sort of routine sort of tasks. And I'm actually counting on that, because if we don't have automation in our future, then we have no standard of living increase, because we've been automating jobs, automating tasks, which has ultimately led to displacement of jobs over time for 200 years. So if we don't, then we have stagnation. So that's the irony. Those that worry about secular stagnation, I think that that's being completely misframed. Stagnation is not the concern. Stagnation is not in our future. It's disruption. That's the challenge. So what will happen going forward likely is that, you know, we looked at the type of tasks. So there's 41. Roughly half are what we would call uniquely human, and by uniquely human means that computer technology is a complement or increases the relative value of human beings in the process. So they could involve everything from creative intelligence to perhaps the most important skill any of us could have in the future, which is emotional intelligence, to things around technological acumen, and there's many more. So we did a lot of the analysis. What we found is that the high likelihood that 10 years from now there will be more jobs in the United States, not fewer. So not only will, you know, there won't be 50% fewer jobs, though actually will probably be 20 to 30% more jobs, total employment, than there are today. However, there's also likely, when you look at the task distribution and then you map the sort of tasks that are likely to be automated, some occupations do have very few number of tasks that they rely upon. Oh, and by the way, those tasks are not really uniquely human. And then when you add up how many jobs there are in those fields, then you find, yeah, roughly 20 to 30% of the occupations, you know, we'll see the number of jobs in those occupations across the country decline over time. So, you know, there's good news and bad news, too. So I'm an economist. I can make both arguments, right? But when you do the deep analysis, you do find more jobs, not fewer, but they're almost entirely going to be in occupations that have a high skew towards what we call uniquely human work. So the funny thing is when we looked at it, is we are seeing, and this is where it's lost in this sort of, I would call, techno-pessimistic future. Although automation is a challenge, everyone assumes that human beings are not uptasking themselves. And what we found is just over the past 15 years, you look over 1,000 occupations, and we use big data techniques to do this, we found on average a 50% change in the type of task that an average worker does today versus what they do 15 years ago. 50%, which is a massive. That's, to me, I push strongly those that worry about secular stagnation. I said, you got the wrong nouns. I said, you know, this is an economy undergoing disruption, which is why I think we have very fast job growth in the United States, yet very low productivity. And the why that is because the economy, I think, is effectively reforming itself into a new way of doing things. Now, I can't prove that to you, but I can tell you it's probably the only thing that explains why businesses continue to add workers, because they see a value in adding workers, right? They obviously see a return on their investment, else they wouldn't be hiring workers. And yet we have a low productivity and aggregate growth rate. We did see this one time in our history, and we saw this during the last Industrial Revolution when electricity started to spread around the economy. So an amazing amount of technological change, and you saw rapid job growth, but you didn't see any sort of productivity at the margin. That's because I think the economy is having to sink new costs. Ultimately, to the higher potential investment, but there's a transaction cost here as some old way of doing things now are integrated with AI and automation. Now, I don't know when that process is done, but I think it's something that I think has been underestimated. So, the good news, though, is we'll have more jobs. That gets to my statement earlier that irony is that most all the new jobs will be really focused in uniquely human sort of occupations or skewed there, which means that the challenge will be we will struggle at times to keep up with the supply of workers will fall short of the demand in certain fields, which which is probably why at the margin income inequality will continue to rise if our diagnosis of technology and how that is shifting the distribution of tasks in aggregate in the economy goes forward. So, you know, there is definitely some good news there. It means the return on education is still going to be high. It means companies that nail this sort of, profile are probably going to win in the marketplace. But there are going to be some industries under pressure in the way they have been, some occupations. But it's not going to be like retailing versus manufacturing. I think that's too simplistic. I think you have to look into the individual job codes and look at occupations that are really just repetitive in nature in terms of their tasks, rather than just labeling it at the industry level. At least that's what we found.
Our guest has been Joe Davis. He's Global Chief Economist at Vanguard and also head of the Vanguard Investment Strategy Group. Joe, you have given us a lot to think about. Thanks for taking us on the drive.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.